devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Sanyavani Paskuchade Satarane. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutala Padakamalam. Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vikratam Vitamscha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's January 24th, 2012. Skype class reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 15. The Pandavas Retire, Timely Text 10. Panchyastadadmikaha klipta mahabhisheka. Slagista charu kabaram kitavai sabayam. Sprishtam vikirya padayo patitashrumukya. Yas tat striyo krita hase hatesha vimukta kesha. Patnyaha. Of the wife. Tava. Your Adimaka, during the great sacrificial ceremony, Klipta, dressed, Maha Abhisheka, greatly sanctified. Shlagishta, thus glorified. Charu, beautiful. Kabaram, clustered hair. Kittavai, by the miscreants. Sabhayam, in the great assembly. Sprishtam, being caught. Vikirya, being loosened. Padayo, on the feet. Patita Ashru Mukyaha, of the one who fell down with tears in the eyes. Yaha, he, tut, there, Shriyaha, wives, Akrita became Hataisha, bereft of husbands, Vimuktakeshaha, loosened hair. One thing we can notice here in the Sanskrit is the use of the letter L, Kripta. It's a Sanskrit letter that's used very rarely. You can have a whole book, a whole shastra, and you'll never see that particular letter. It's very, very rare. Also, we just make a note in the Sanskrit that Arjuna is speaking to Maharaj Yudhisthira about Draupadi, calling him Patnyaha Tava, your wife, instead of our wife, although Draupadi was their mutual wife. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. It was he only who loosened the hair of all the wives of the miscreants, who dared open the cluster of your queen's hair, which had been nicely dressed and sanctified for the great Rajasuya sacrificial ceremony. At that time, she fell down at the feet of Lord Krishna with tears in her eyes. Purport. Queen Draupadi had a beautiful bunch of hair, which was sanctified in the ceremonial function of Rajasuya Yajna. But when she was lost in a bet, Dushasana touched her glorified hair to insult her. Draupadi then fell down at the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. And Lord Krishna decided that all the wives of Dushasana and company should have their hair loosened as a result of the Battle of Kurukshetra. Thus, after the Battle of Kurukshetra, after all the sons and grandsons of Dhritarashtra died in battle, all the wives of the family were obliged to loosen their hair as widows. In other words, all the wives of the Kuruk family became widows because of Dushasana's insulting a great devotee of the Lord. The Lord can tolerate insults upon himself by any miscreant because the father tolerates even insults from the son, but he never tolerates insults upon his devotees. By insulting a great soul, one has to forego all the results of pious acts and benedictions also. Patnyas tavad mikaha klipta mahabhisheka shlashchishtacharu kavararam kitavai sabayam spristam vikirya padayo patashru patitashru mukya yas tach triyo kritahatesha vimuktake shaha. It was he only, meaning Krishna, who loosened the hair of all the wives of the miscreants, who dared open the cluster of your queen's hair, which had been nicely dressed and sanctified for the great Rajasuya sacrificial ceremony. At that time, she fell down at the feet of Lord Krishna with tears in her eyes. So this, again, is part of Arjuna lamenting the passing of Krishna from the world, and he's remembering in one verse after another the glorious acts of Krishna in relationship to the Pandavas. When Krishna disappeared from the Rasalila, the gopis were remembering in a similar way Krishna's activities in Vrindavan, how Krishna killed this or that demon, how he performed various leelas, how he performed pastimes with them. And in this way they became somewhat pacified. So Arjuna also, by remembering Krishna, is becoming somewhat pacified. And in the end, he'll focus on Krishna's instructions on the Bhagavad Gita and go back to Godhead. So this is one of the descriptions here, how Krishna avenged the insult to their queen Draupadi, that Draupadi had her beautiful hair was nicely decorated as the empress of the world. One can just imagine what kind of a gorgeous hairstyle she had. And then Maha Abhisheka, her hair was sanctified. So Vedic culture knew how to sanctify everything. And hair is normally something dirty, unclean, contaminated. But the hair of Empress Draupadi, Queen Draupadi, was sanctified by an Abhishek in order to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice with Maharaj Yudhisthira. So everything had become purified and holy This, of course, is Krishna's instruction in the Bhagavad Gita in 4:24, how to make everything in life holy, everything sanctified. Prabhupada talks about in Krishna book, in Krishna's activities, he says that generally our term of material existence is going on because of family attachment, but Krishna shows how we can sanctify our family life. So that, of course, is also the philosophy of Yukta Vairagya, how to sanctify everything. So the sanctified hair of Draupadi, it was undone, it was loosened, it was the beautiful hairstyling, the sanctification was undone, it was polluted, it was ruined by Dushasan out of his envy of the position of the Pandavas, out of his lust for Draupadi. He polluted everything, like we read about the demons who pollute the sacrifices. When Balaram went to Namasharanya, there was this demon Balvala that was throwing bones and stool, he was throwing, and urine on the sacrifice and on the area. So this is the mood of the demons. They take something nice and they pollute it. So the devotees, they sanctify everything. Even one's hair can become sanctified. And the demons, they want to destroy everything. And what did Krishna do? So Krishna said, okay, you're going to loosen the hair of my devotee, so all of the hair of your wives will also be loosened. Because in that society, if the husband died, then the women would undo their beautiful hairstyles as a sign of mourning. They would destroy the nice. These were also the princesses and the queens of the various persons. They were all royalty in the battlefield. So they also had beautifully decorated hair, and that was destroyed when their husbands were dead. So Arjuna is meditating on this in separation from Krishna, Krishna's justice, Krishna's kindness. He was really appreciating how much love Krishna has for his devotees, as Prabhupada's describing here, that Krishna has so much love for his devotees that he doesn't tolerate any insults. As Prabhupada says here, the father can tolerate insults to himself. And if any of us who are parents, we know that if our child says something insulting to us, we tolerate it. You know, the little children, they say things like, I hate you, mommy, you know, you took my toy away, and we tolerate. We don't become offended. But if one of our children is insulting one of our other children, that we don't tolerate. That we take strong action, especially if a child, if older child is harassing a weaker child. And Srila Prabhupada makes the point here, by insulting a great soul, one has to forgo all the results of pious acts and benedictions also. This is stated many, many times throughout the Shastra, that service to a devotee or harming a devotee, insulting a devotee, it has a very different effect than ordinary karma, bad karma, good karma, or even benedictions. Even the benedictions of great souls. That the how one treats a devotee trumps everything. And this is what Arjuna is meditating on. It's not exactly that Arjuna is meditating on some sort of vengeful attitude. Or, oh, we got our enemies, you know, our wife's hair was insulted and goody, goody, the enemies died and their wives became widows. No, he's meditating on how much love the Lord has for the devotees and how ultimately the ultimate thing in the universe is love. It's asked in, later on in the Bhagavatam, how is it that the Lord is neutral when he favors the devotees? How do we say that he's actually equipoised? I mean, that one of the main qualities of the devotee is that the devotee is equipoised. The devotee doesn't see a difference between friends, enemies, and neutral parties. The devotee, I mean, even a beginning transcendentalist, even an impersonalist transcendentalist, what to speak of a devotee, even a mystic yogi, they don't have different feelings towards friends, enemies, and neutral parties. They see everyone with an equal mind. That doesn't mean they treat everyone equally, although there are some great devotees who do that as avadutas. But it doesn't mean they, you know, sleep with a tiger or sleep with a python. because they don't have any sense of discrimination. Doesn't mean they're a fool, but it means they don't have a feeling of enmity for someone just because that person is harming them. You know, generally, in this world, if someone does something nice for me, then I like them. If someone does something that's not nice for me, I don't like them. And if someone's neutral towards me, I'm neutral towards them. But the devotee, even the lower grade, shall we say, transcendentalist, doesn't have those sort of feelings. They see that whatever anyone does to me or for me, that that is ultimately the will of the Lord, and it's all good. They're not distinguishing this is good, this is bad. They're seeing everything is good. Not everything is good materially, but everything is good from a transcendental perspective. So if the beginning transcendentalist, if just the Brahman-realized transcendentalist has this sense of being equipoised, then surely Krishna also has this sense. That argument is made throughout the Shastra, that if the devotees are detached from material life, surely Krishna must be detached from material life. So Krishna's equipoised, and yet he appears to favor the devotees. In fact, he does favor the devotees. Bhaktivatsal, his quality of Bhaktivatsal, trumps all of his other qualities. He will put aside his other qualities in order to love the devotee. And here we see that his love for the devotee is the greatest principle in the universe. It's above the principle of karma. It's above the principle of benedictions. So how is it if the Lord is neutral? And the answer, of course, is given in the seventh canto, that although the Lord is neutral, still reality favors the mode of goodness. And this is just logical. Goodness also means truth, sattva. Sattva means both goodness and truth. So in other words, when we say the world favors the mode of goodness, we say everything favors what it is. In other words, things work best if you use them for what they are, rather than using them for something else. You know, whatever tool you have, if you use a hammer as a hammer, then it's going to fulfill your purposes better than if you try to use a hammer as, you know, a screwdriver or as some other kind of tool. So the universe is also like that. If you use the universe the way it's designed, then you're happier. And to whatever extent we use things in a way other than the way they're designed, to whatever extent we use them falsely, to that extent we're unhappy. So the way the universe is designed ultimately is that of love. I mean, if we look at here pious acts, I mean, what are the results of pious acts? So according to Shastra, a person gets the results of pious acts, good karma, basically. By what? By one's desires. One has desires for certain things. By doing work that's in accord with the Shastra, by following the instructions of the scriptures, by performing sacrifices. Sacrifices basically mean that you're paying for what you're enjoying. As Krishna explains in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that the rains are coming and you're sacrificing to the demigods. You're paying for them. Prabhupada compares it to paying for your, you know, your electric bill or your water bill. You're giving something back. You're acknowledging. This is considered a proper behavior in any human society, not to steal. Not to steal money, not to steal goods, not to steal anything. Basically, to only take from somebody what you are doing in exchange for, what they're willing to give you for that exchange. And then austerities. One also gets good karma by performing austerities. It said the word for suffering and austerities, tapa, is the same. And it says in the fourth canto that one can reduce one's suffering by performing austerities. It's something like that you can do, instead, if you have a jail sentence, you can choose to do community service instead. You can take some sort of austerities. Also, you can get a good material situation by performing mystic yoga, where you learn how to control your body and mind. So these are all ways in which people enjoy the world. You enjoy the world by having material desires, by then doing good pious works in the Shastra, by performing sacrifices as given in the Shastra, proper sacrifices, by doing austerities again. The sacrifices and austerities would have to be in the mode of goodness, or at least in the mode of passion, to get you good results. By performing yoga, and by getting the benediction and the blessing of the demigods or of some saintly persons. So the way the laws of the universe work is if you do all of those things, you'll have a nice material situation. However, more important than all of those things is bhakti. So if you do all of those things and you violate the principles of bhakti, then you don't get the results of all of those things. The results of all of those things get taken away. And conversely, if you don't do all of those things and you have bhakti, then you get all the good results. So it's almost like things are working on several levels. You know, they're working on the levels of, well, there's this rule and there's this injunction and you have to do this to get good karma. And then they're also working on the level of personal loving relationships, which are much more important. And we see this in our own human existence, that if I feel that somebody really cares about me and cares about those who are dear to me, then I will generally excuse if they engage in behavior that's not so nice. But even if somebody's engaging in very perfect and nice behavior, if I feel that they don't care about me or they insult me, or what to speak if they insult those who are dear to me, then their good behavior doesn't count for much for me. You know, we're mostly concerned about the relationships rather than just the external behavior. So we like that because Krishna's like that. And we can think of a number of examples. I was trying to think of as many as I could. And interestingly enough, I found it much easier to think of the negative than the positive. So I was thinking of examples of somebody who had gotten very good material situation by their good karma or by their austerities or by their yoga or some combination of that. And they lost it because they offended Vaishnava. So I thought one example is Kamsa. His offenses, especially to Vasudeva and Devaki, but to so many Vaishnavas. And even though he was very materially qualified, everything was taken away. Another example, of course, is Hiranyakashipu. And it was interesting, the demigods were complaining when Hiranyakashipu did his austerities and got the benedictions of Brahma. But they were told by the Lord, don't worry, I'll arrange that he'll have a great devotee as a child. And when he harasses his devotee child, then he'll lose the results of his karma. If you just think of how it works, you know, it's like you've amassed all these good karma coins. You know, you've amassed a big bank account of good karma. And you're there spending it and enjoying spending it. And then because you offend a Vaishnava, you just lose it all. You just lose it all. And you can't jump up and down and say, well, I follow the rules. You know, I've got this good karma because there's a higher rule going on. So, you know, Hiranyakashipu had done austerities that, according to universal law, he could have run the universe for a very long time. But he only ran the universe for, what, about 5 years? Right? When he came back from his austerities was when Prahlad was born. And it was only when Prahlad was 5 that Nrisingadev came. So Hiranyakashipu only got to, you know, so-called enjoy the world for 5 years instead of 500,000 million billion years, which is what he deserved from his austerity because he insulted a Vaishnava. And, of course, Ravana also. Ravana was a very competent material person with much opulence that must have been the result of past activities and because of offending Sita, because of offending Hanuman. And he lost everything. And here the example, of course, is the Kurus. The Kurus were also they had a lot of good karma. They were very wealthy. They were beautiful. They were strong. They were intelligent. They were learned. They had a lot of power. And by insulting Draupadi, of course, they also insulted Yudhisthira and the other Pandavas. They tried to kill them so many times. But particularly this insult to Draupadi seemed to be the action that really sealed their fate, that they were going to lose all their opulence, they were going to lose their life, everything was going to be finished prematurely. The example also of Durvasa Muni, that Durvasa Muni was so great, not just in fruitive activities, but also in yoga. And because he tried to kill Maharaj Ambarish over a slight, or we could say imagined insult, so everything was going to be taken away. Daksha is another example. Daksha was almost at the level of Brahma in power and influence and knowledge. And because he offended Lord Shiva, so he literally lost his head. You know, we have an English expression, he lost his head, but he really lost his head. And how'd you like to walk around with a goat's head? So not very nice. And then, of course, he offended Narada in another life. And there's the example of Suruchi, the wife of Utanapad. So these personalities, Suruchi, Utanapad, they're living at the beginning of the universe. They're in a very close descendants of Lord Brahma. I think he's like the grandson of Lord Brahma, I believe. So very qualified persons. You read the descriptions of Utanapad's palace. I believe he has a staircase made out of solid emeralds. So what kind of opulence did Suruchi enjoy? And yet, because she offended Dhruva Maharaj. And interestingly enough with that is that Dhruva was not a Vaishnava at the time that she offended him. He became a Vaishnava later. But because she offended him, and then also when he returned to the kingdom, you'll find Suruchi says, long may you live, but she never asked for forgiveness. So because of that, she and her son, they both died in a forest fire. Or he was killed by Yaksha, and she died in a forest fire looking for him. And Prabhupada says in that purport that if you serve a devotee without knowledge, you get a good result, and if you offend a devotee, even without knowledge, you do not know where you are going. So these are some examples: Kamsa, Hiranyakashipu, Ravana, the Kurus, Dravasa, Suruchi, Daksha, who had materially speaking, by following the material rules of the universe, they had great facility for material enjoyment. They had a great position in the material world, but their enjoyment was cut short. Their account was withdrawn because they offended a devotee of the Lord. They were deemed as not worthy of being able to enjoy what they've earned. Of course, this shows us what Prabhupada talks about all the time, that whatever we get in this world is not only the result of our own action, but it's also the result of the grace of the Lord. And, of course, Krishna denied this philosophy to Nanda Maharaj. Nanda Maharaj was saying we have to worship Indra because whatever we have in the world is due to the grace of the gods. And Krishna said, no, if you do your duty, everything will come automatically. You don't need any grace of the gods. And many people think like that. You know, if I'm just a good person, if I just do my duty, if I'm pious, if I'm nice, then I'll have a good life. And that's true. But one needs the grace of God also. And especially the grace of God where he sees that you're going to be kind to his devotees who are dependent upon him. So I was also trying to think of examples of the opposite of persons who were materially didn't have such a good situation, and by service to the devotees, they were able to overcome a bad situation. I thought about the dog that became attached to Shivananda Sen. I thought, oh, he was in a dog's body, and that because he served a Vaishnava, therefore he became elevated, went back to Godhead. There's, of course, Jatayu, who was in the body of a vulture, which, you know, a vulture body, even among birds, the vulture is considered a very lowly bird. If you really want to insult somebody, you call them a vulture. You know, one who takes advantage, one who takes pleasure in others' misfortune, one who's hoping. A vulture is hoping that others will become misfortunate so he can take advantage of that. And because Jatayu served Sita Devi, therefore he was treated as Ram's father. He went back to Godhead. I was thinking also about Maharaj Prataparudra. Of course, he wasn't in a bad material situation, but how just by serving Ramananda Roy. Another example is the crocodile. This is a very funny story. The Prabhupada, in one lecture, says that the reason that the crocodile that was attacking Gajendra's feet became liberated is because he was touching the feet of a Vaishnava. And of course, that's especially funny because he was touching the feet of a Vaishnava to try to hurt him, to try to eat him. And still, you know, he got that benefit, Prabhupada said. Of course, not that we should try to serve a benefit, but try to serve a devotee by chewing on their feet. Of course, there was Kavi Karnapur, and he was sucking on the toe of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and from that he became a great writer, but that was a little different. He was a baby. And we think of Kaliya. So Kaliya was a demon, but he had Vaishnava wives. And his Vaishnava wives were always preaching to him, and they were always hoping for his welfare. And actually, because of his relationship with his Vaishnava wives, he ultimately also became delivered. And Sanatana Goswami says that he became even the Lord's carrier. Therefore, we can see that real good fortune actual good fortune, permanent good fortune, is service to the Vaishnavas. And bad fortune is offenses to the Vaishnavas. Material good fortune, not only is it temporary in every sense of the word, but it's not something solid. It's not really the highest kind of good fortune. You're not working on the highest principle of the universe to get that kind of fortune. You're therefore not getting the highest kind of fortune that there is. Because, again, all of us who are parents, we know that if somebody does something nice for our children, then we have great affection for that person. It's very simple. This is one of the biggest problems with being a teacher. When you're a teacher, the parents like you because you're doing nice things for their children. But if you have to go to the parents, which you do have to do sometimes, and say, you know, your child failed a spelling test or your child was misbehaving in school, you can become the parent's permanent enemy. And it's like that. You know, if someone says something nice about my child, then I'll do anything for them. And if they say something nasty about my child, then I'll do anything to them. And Krishna has those sort of feelings, that the devotees who are fully surrendered to him, who are fully in love with him, who are fully dependent on him, first of all, those persons are faultless. They never want to do harm to anyone. They're magnanimous. They're the friend of everyone. And if there's somebody who wants to do them harm, they may tolerate it, but Krishna will never tolerate it. And if there's someone who wants to do good for them, Krishna will always remember that. So this is really, in many ways, an essential feature of advancing in bhakti yoga. It's not a detail. It's not something on the side. But it's really, if I want to gain the Lord's favor, and ultimately I have to gain the Lord's favor to achieve bhakti. I cannot gain even lasting material things without the Lord's favor, or anything material without the Lord's favor. I can't gain even liberation into the Brahman without the Lord's favor. What to speak of bhakti? That's what bhakti's about. Bhakti's about exchanging favorable love. That's what Rupa Goswami says has to be favorable. Not just actions for the Lord, but actions for the Lord that are favorable. Not just thinking of the Lord, like Kamsa's thinking of the Lord, but not favorably. Something that will please him. And the best thing that will please him is to serve his devotees and to please his devotees. And the thing that will displease him the most is to offend the devotees. So, of course, this is sometimes a challenge because we need to associate with devotees, and we need to associate with devotees on a regular basis. Karna guna sangasya, we become whatever we associate with. But whenever we associate with somebody on a regular basis, it's hard always to treat them with respect. You know, we're going to see their faults, they're going to offend us sometimes or insult us sometimes, and we're going to become angry and, you know, so many things. And it's very, very difficult to remember that we're dealing with devotees. Oh, we can forget this. And therefore, we may be going on 5, 10, 15, 20, 40, 100 years in bhakti and not making much progress. So this is the sort of, you know, we talk about this a lot. This is the first offense, to offend the devotees, to blaspheme the devotees who've dedicated their lives for propagation of the holy name of the Lord. To be careful of committing this offense and to be alert to do the opposite. To be alert to serve the devotees. And what devotees should we serve? I mean, in the story of Gajendra, Gajendra is called by Rupa Goswami as one of the Kanista Adhikaris, that Gajendra was approaching the Lord to be free from distress, not for pure devotional service. And still, the crocodile, just by touching Gajendra's feet, became liberated by the Lord. Or Dhruva, when Dhruva was insulted by Suruchi, he hadn't even begun his devotional service. So basically, one should see the devotees as everyone, Jivara Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasha. The devotee shouldn't offend anyone. And of course, in the family, sometimes in family matters, there may be some leniency, but we can see that even some of these offenses to devotees or serving the devotees were among family members. Suruchi was insulting her stepson, and she had to perish for that. Dushasan was also related to Draupadi. right? That he was brother and sister-in-law. And still he was not excused. Kamsa was harassing his own cousin's sister and her husband. Hiranyakashipu, his own son. Kali was serving his own wives. So that doesn't matter. You can't say, well, this person is my relative, and therefore it's okay if I don't have respect for them, or it's okay if I insult them, because after all, they're my family members. No, if your family member is also a spirit soul, is also part and parcel of Krishna, ultimately is a Vaishnava. What to speak if your family member is engaged in any kind of devotional service? When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was asked, how do you recognize a Vaishnava? He says, anyone who even one time says Hare Krishna, that person should be accepted as a Vaishnava. And Rupa Goswami says that the person who chants Hare Krishna, they should be at least respected within the mind as a Vaishnava, even as the beginning devotee. So preferably we respect everyone. We don't offend anyone. And we shouldn't disrespect even an ant. I mean, we have many reasons why we're vegetarian. The primary reason is patram pushpam palam toyam, that Krishna wants vegetarian food offered to him, and we only eat what Krishna eats. But another reason we're vegetarian is we don't want to offend any living entity. Why should we offend some living entity just for some unnecessary addition, you know, variety in our diet? We have sufficient food to have all the palatable taste possible. We have sufficient food for good health. Why should we offend any living entity? The devotees will not offend even an ant or a bug. But the irony is that we can be very nice to the little bugs, and we'll be nice to the cows, and we'll be nice to the, you know, trees, and then we'll be cruel to the people that we live with. And we forget that they're just as much living entities as anybody else. What to speak of if the people that we live with and we work with are Vaishnavas? And they may be beginning Vaishnavas, advanced Vaishnavas, it doesn't matter. Of course, that doesn't mean the devotee lets himself be mistreated, but still one always treats others with respect. Therefore, Yudhisthira is known as Ajatashastra, one whose enemy was never born. Yudhisthira had no sense of enmity towards the Kurus. He never offended the Kurus. You find that Draupadi and the Pandavas, they never offended the Kurus. That wasn't their mood at all. In fact, they were constantly trying to have a decent relationship with them. They were always trying to treat them with respect. It was the Kurus who were always disrespectful. So this is the mood of the devotee, and it can't be emphasized how essential this is. And respecting all living entities doesn't mean that one is a fool. It doesn't mean that one loses one's discrimination. It doesn't mean that in the name of not offending the devotees and loyalty, that one cooperates with irreligious or improper policies and behaviors. But it does mean that I always treat everybody with respect. And if we think about what is the essence of respect, the essence of respect is knowing that everybody has free will. And this was very nice explained, let's see if I can find it quickly. This was very nice explained by the Avadhuta that Prahlad Maharaj met, who was lying like a python. And again, I'm not sure if I can find this very quickly. But when he was talking to, he was talking to Prahlad. Said something about how he treats others. I'm just looking for this. Oh, here it is. Okay, it's 7:13:42. Different people are of different mentalities, he says. Therefore, it is not my business either to praise them or to blaspheme them. I only desire their welfare, hoping they will agree to become one with the Super Soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. So he sees that some people are engaged in sinful activities, some people are engaged in pious activities, but he simply desires their welfare. He's simply thinking, how can I do good for them? How can I do good for them? He's not interested in ordinary praise or ordinary blame. And another way that we can show respect for persons is by realizing that everybody has free will. That we cannot, of course, when you have young children or students, you're obliged to train them. We were just reading how Prabhupada said his father would say, "You please excuse me, but it is my duty to train you because you're my son." Even Mahaprabhu's father had to say to the Lord, "You know, I'm sorry, I have to train you because you're my son. I have to correct you." So we're obligated, it's our duty to give training and correction to those who are under our authority. And that training and correction may mean that we tell them they have to do something even when they don't want to. You have to tell a child, okay, it's time now to go to bed, or it's time to eat this, and even if they say no, still, they don't really have the position that you're going to accept their no. You know, okay, it's time to go to bed. No, I don't want to go to bed. You don't say, okay, you don't have to go to bed. So when it comes to subordinates, we may have to impose our will upon them, sometimes for their own good. But in general, respecting all living entities also means that we don't try to impose our will upon them. We allow them the respect that they can choose their own course in life, that they can say no to us, that we don't try to be the controller of material energy, and we don't try to be a controller of another living entity. And of course, that's the mood of Krishna, that Krishna allows the living entity, respects the living entity enough to give them their free will. So these are some different ways that we can show respect, by always desiring a person's welfare, by giving them the right to say no. Another way, of course, of showing respect to all living entities, and this is quite hard, amanina manadena, is to try to understand their point of view, to try to actually be empathetic. As Krishna says in the 6th chapter, that a true yogi sees the happiness and distress of others according to his own understanding. So when somebody insults me, when somebody offends me, when somebody hurts me, I generally tend to see it from my perspective, and I become angry and I may insult them. You know, like that's how the Kurus saw this. The Kurus saw the way that Dushasan and Duryodhan, the way they interpreted this whole thing, is they interpreted it that Yudhisthira and his brothers had usurped the kingdom from them. That was their interpretation of the facts. Their interpretation was, you know, Dhritarashtra should have become the king. And then he did actually become the king on the death of Pandu. And therefore, Dhritarashtra's sons should have inherited the throne. And for Yudhisthira to inherit the throne was improper. They saw Yudhisthira as an usurper. And they were very frustrated with the fact that Yudhisthira had more of the love and the loyalty of the people than they did. And they felt, therefore, that they were morally justified in taking to unfair means to get Yudhisthira off the throne. That was how they saw it. Now, their interpretation of the events was not the same as that as of course, Krishna's interpretation of the events. So that the devotee also, one way that we don't insult anybody is we try to understand how they're seeing things. We try to understand from their perspective. Because it's very difficult to help somebody on the right path if I see things from their perspective. So therefore the devotee, you could say, even if they chastise someone, they make excuses for them. Just like Narada, when he cursed the sons of Kuvera, still he made excuses for them. He said, well, they're born in a rich family, and it's natural that if someone's born in a rich family, they may become proud and they may misuse their riches. So let me help them. So in this way, the devotee also is able to be free of insulting people and blaspheming people. That even if someone does something wrong, and say, okay, I understand. I understand how this person is thinking. I can say that what they did is wrong, but I'm not going to criticize them. Because after all, even in this world, if your child commits a heinous crime, you still love them as your child. And that is Krishna's view towards all his living entities. So these are certainly hard to do. It's hard to have respect for other living entities. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's not easy to respect the devotees. It's definitely not easy. And it's the doorway to the higher realms of bhakti. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about amanina manidena as the key to nishta. And Prabhupada says that it's a hard struggle with determination until nishta, and after that everything comes automatically one after another. So if we're still thinking that bhakti is a hard struggle, if we haven't dealt with the majority of our anartas, then the real key is that we're not doing this trinadapi suniche na tarori vasa hishnuna amanina manidena kirtaniya siddhahari. That's what to say. That's the fact. That's what's holding us back. Some lack of respect for other living entities, particularly for the devotees. Some mistreatment of the devotees. That even if we've done so much service, and even if we've been following the instructions of Srila Prabhupada, we've been following the instructions of the scripture, if we have an offensive or insulting mentality, then we're stuck. We can't fit through the doorway. It's just like if somebody's really overweight and it's a small doorway and they can't fit through. So something like that. So we have to understand from this example of Draupadi and so many examples that the main thing Krishna's looking for is love and respect for himself and especially for his devotees. That's much more important to him than benedictions. You know, people come all the time, give me your blessing, give me this blessing, give me this benediction. Prabhupada says right here, you'll lose all your benedictions if you don't treat the devotees nicely. You'll use all your pious acts. You can do so many pious acts, so many good things, be such a good person, stockpile all of your sukriti, and if you can't treat the devotees nicely, it's not worth anything. And even if you don't have benedictions, and even if you don't have the sukriti, even if you're a vulture or a crocodile or a poisonous snake, if you can somehow or other get the association of devotees and please and serve them, then you'll achieve everything far beyond what you could achieve through fruitive activities. So even though it's very difficult, even though it requires a lot of empathy, a lot of humility, a lot of consideration, and a lot of respect, it's worth doing. And it's worth doing right. It's not a detail. It's the most essential thing that we do. And to treat others with respect, even when we're not treated with respect. In fact, even more so. Even more so, because if I'm not being treated with respect, that may be indicative that I'm not a respectful person, that I don't treat others with respect. And even more so, therefore, if people are treating me disrespectfully, if I would like to be treated respectfully, even more so I should put out that mood towards others. So here Arjuna is meditating on how much love the Lord has for his devotees, how caring the Lord is to want to preserve the beautiful hairstyle, the sanctified, the abhishekt hairstyle of Draupadi for the Rajasuya Jagya, and how deeply the Lord was affected by Draupadi falling down with tears in her eyes, such that all of the wives of those who insulted her, they also had to loosen their hair in mourning. So, questions, comments?
Okay, Bruce, so this is your opportunity. If you would like to ask any questions or make any comments, then please go right ahead.
I'll try to go fast. Thinking about making offenses to anybody or, you know, somehow offending somebody unknowingly even, it just seems to me like, well, we're kind of screwed if we do and kind of screwed if we don't. How in the world do you avoid making offenses when you don't even know what you're doing? I mean, it just seems rather... Can you give us some hope?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, the less you know what you're doing, the less culpable you are. So that's explained in the fifth canto. And that's true in human laws also. People who are mentally ill or people who are children are not held as accountable under the law. So the more you're aware of what you're doing, the more you're held accountable. Of course, if you don't know what you're doing intentionally, If you commit a crime because you're under the influence of intoxication, you are held accountable because you've willfully taken the intoxication, which has made you not know what you're doing. But this is also true in the universe, that the more innocent you are, the less you're held accountable. But we're not supposed to stay on the platform of ignorance. So at a certain point, you're supposed to know. You know, if a 20-year-old says, well, I just don't, you know, I don't know what side of the street I'm supposed to drive on, that is criminal, because at a certain point you are supposed to know. So as we advance in Krishna consciousness, one of the things we're supposed to become aware of is what is offensive and what is not offensive. How am I supposed to behave? And frankly, the more we advance, the more we can be held to account, because we're more capable, just than anything else. You know, if someone goes to school when they're little, you know, you don't even expect them to recognize their alphabet. But at a certain point, you can say to them, I expect you to read 20 pages in the book, and they should be able to do it because they know how to read. So I do think there's hope. We have at our particular stage of awareness, we should at least be doing our best to act according to our level of awareness. And when we mess up, I'm not going to say if we mess up, when we mess up, then we have to have enough humility to have a genuine apology. And it's explained in Harinam Chintamani that, you know, if you've offended somebody, you've really got to be willing to work at it until they're satisfied. And if you reach a point where they're not satisfied, then you can chant constantly. But if whoever we've offended, we have a responsibility to find that out and to try to satisfy that person as much as possible, as much as we can. To ask forgiveness, if they won't forgive us, Bhaktivinoda Thakura says we serve them. And if they're still not satisfied, then we just chant constantly. So we do mess up. We mess up all the time. And when we mess up, then we have to ask forgiveness and go on. It's not that we kill ourselves over it. But we should also make a practice, make a habit of treating people with respect, being aware of it, and being aware of what kind of thoughts and words and behavior do I do that shows a lack of respect and consideration and understanding for others. I mean, I know how painful it is when other people treat me without any consideration and understanding. It's extremely painful. So I want to do my best not to treat anybody like that. I mean, from a karmic perspective, from a bhakti perspective, from an anything perspective. And it's like anything else, you know, it takes deliberate practice, deliberate meditation. And I think it's hopeful. I mean, I've seen so many persons, I mean, even non-devotees can practice being more respectful and more considerate up to a point. A non-devotee can't do it completely because they're not getting rid of their ultimate selfishness. But I've certainly seen people who make a deliberate, conscious, directed attempt to treat people more respectfully and to treat people with consideration, and they are able to progress. It's not that you just give up and say, I can't do anything. I hope that's helpful.
Hare Krishna Master.
Yes?
Thank you for the class, by the way. I thought it was very enlightening. But also in regard to this question that this mother had asked about, you know, when you don't even know if you're committing offenses, I remember reading in one purport where Srila Prabhupada was explaining, and I believe it was in reference to avoiding offenses of the holy name. And I'm trying to remember what story it was in, because it was in the story, might have been somewhere in the CC. But Srila Prabhupada explains that there are two types of offenseless chanting. One is when we're trying to consciously avoid committing offenses, that's considered offenseless chanting. And one is when we're not aware that we're committing offenses. Basically, we're ignorant of our offenses. So in one sense, he says that's actually also considered offenseless chanting.
Yes, that's something like if someone says Sinarama, or they're not even trying to say the holy name. So that's also considered Namabhas. If somebody says the holy name joking or to indicate something else, or even the syllables are separated,
you know, Harriet. They're saying Hari. So that's also considered Namabhas, yes.
So, and another two, he says the conscious effort to avoid is considered superior, a form of offenseless chanting.
Yes.
So my question is, in the same way that the Namabhas form of chanting, because we're not aware of our chanting, in the same way that that is considered offenseless, could that principle also be applied in the case of Vaishnava Aparad, where we're not aware that committing offenses to devotees?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, the example of not being aware, Suruchi was certainly aware that she was insulting Dhruva. It wasn't that she wasn't aware that she was insulting someone. She wasn't aware that he was a Vaishnava. So that was the point. Not that she was unaware that it was insulting. Anybody would know that that was insulting. So when Prabhupada's talking about unaware, what I understand is he's saying, you know, we may not be aware that the person we're dealing with is more spiritually advanced than we think they are. But I also take those stories to mean that we shouldn't insult anybody. You know, don't say just, well, I'm not going to insult the advanced devotees. Don't insult anybody. Anyway, we're supposed to become aware. That's part of our responsibility, to become aware what is an offense and not to just go on being childlike.
Mother Mila, I have a question.
Yes?
Is there ever a precedent for revenge? This is something that we see in Christianity and Islam, like it's okay. As a matter of fact, God is going to take care of making sure you get revenge. With Draupadi, we saw how when Ashwatthama killed her son, still she was compassionate. But when they were in the forest, she and Bhima were really trying to tell Yudhishthira that you have to go back and do something. You know, and it seemed like revenge at that time. So,
but they were the rulers. So, you know, when we look at things like forgiveness, forgiveness has different levels. It has an external behavior. You know, if someone does something wrong, forgiveness can mean, okay, they don't have to get a punishment for what they've got done wrong. And forgiveness can also mean, I don't want them to get a punishment for what they've done wrong. I would like them to be able to rectify themselves without suffering. So that mentality of, I don't want anyone to have to suffer for what they've done wrong, is always the mentality of the Vaishnava. It's always the mentality of Krishna. That they don't... There's one really nice purport where Prabhupada talks about how Krishna punishes the people with regret. I forget the exact words. But that people getting their karmic, their bad karmic reactions, and Krishna killing demons, he does it regretfully. It's not that, it's not that that's something that he wants to do. Just again, like if you're a parent, you don't want to punish your children. You want your children to be obedient without punishment. No parent wants to have to put their child in time out or take away their dessert or take away their toy or whatever. You know, the parent wants to be able to say to the child, please do this. And the child said, oh, yes, Daddy, I will do that, you know, without any kind of punishment. So that's one level of non-vengefulness. It's an internal mentality of always wishing everybody well, of never wanting anybody to suffer for any reason ever. Even if they've harmed me, I don't want them to have to suffer. I want them to be rectified. Prahlad Maharaj wanted his father to be rectified. And Prahlad Maharaj admitted that his father had hurt him. He wasn't a fool. He said, my father's done grievous, sinful activities to me. But he wanted his father to be rectified in a joyful way. But then there's the external of, do you actually externally punish somebody? So external punishment has to be there. If you're an authority over somebody, that's part of your responsibility. If, just like Prabhupada tells the story of the thief who bit off his aunt's ear because she never gave him any kind of correction, he became a thief. So the parents to the children, the guru to the disciple, and the government to the criminals. It's their duty. If a government doesn't punish criminals, then the government is engaged in sinful activity. Like Arjuna told Krishna, I don't want to fight this battle because it's sinful. And Krishna says, no, if you don't fight the battle, that's sinful. That's your job. So Maharaj Yudhisthira had very much the internal mood of forgiveness, so much so that sometimes he wasn't inclined to do his external job of punishing as the emperor. And Draupadi and Bhima, particularly Arjuna even, they would remind him, this is your duty. This is what you have to do for Krishna. It's not palatable. A devotee is not, even Krishna is not inclined like that. But that's not a mood of vengeance. Vengeance, as I understand it, is the mood that I want the person who hurt me to suffer as much or more than I have suffered. I want them to learn their lesson through suffering. I want to gain a sense that they understand my pain by having them experience that pain. Now, that may actually be necessary. It may be that the only way they'll have understanding and empathy is by going through a similar experience, but I would much prefer that they get understanding and empathy in another way. So I see punishment is a mood of punishment, which is vengeance, and an action of punishment, which may be service. So Dharma the Bull said, if you ever blame the perpetrator, then you're as evil as the perpetrator. You know, if you name the perpetrator, if you say, this is the person who's responsible for my suffering, then you've also gone down to a low level yourself. But if you're, because ultimately our suffering is all due to my own behavior, and the perpetrator is just the instrument of my own karma. They're the instrument of Krishna teaching me a lesson. It's like blaming the delivery man that you get a bill in the mail. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. I got a bill in the mail because I bought something I haven't paid for. Not because the postman is not personally responsible, nor is the company even responsible for sending me the bill. I'm responsible because I'm the one who got something and haven't paid for it yet. So the devotee always has that mentality. The devotee never points a finger and says, you're the one who's responsible for my suffering. However, if the person who is responsible for suffering is someone over whom we have authority, then we do have a responsibility to correct them. And if we don't correct them, then we're negligent in our service.
So vengeance and revenge is something that's absent in the spiritual world. There's no parallel for it. It's only here in the material world.
Correct.
Otherwise,
well, in the spiritual world, there's no justice at all. There, it just doesn't exist. The whole concept of justice and fairness doesn't exist there at all. First of all, it wouldn't even make any sense. 1 + 1 = 1 and 1 - 1 = 1. There's abundance. There's unlimited abundance. So you don't have to say, I get 3 and you get 3 and you get 3. Everybody can have unlimited. And there's no time and space. It's not that, you know, like here, if I have the chair, you can't have it. But in spiritual existence, we can all have the chair. So there's no concept like that. It doesn't exist. This whole concept of fairness and justice is a material concept. Just like in today's verse, we're seeing that love for the devotees trumps karma. You know, if you have bad karma, but you serve a devotee, you get everything. And if you have good karma and you offend a devotee, you lose everything. You know, whatever you've earned with your karma, that's not the ultimate law. There's a higher law. There's a law of love. So in the spiritual world, only the higher law is operative. Bhaktivinoda Thakura says there's only two laws in the spiritual world, love and don't envy. That's it. There's no need for any other law. There's no business. There's no justice. It just doesn't exist. The whole concept doesn't exist. It's a completely materialistic concept. Actually, it's a concept in the mode of passion. The whole concept of justice and fairness comes from the mode of passion, from material dharma and righteousness. And therefore, the kshatriyas who epitomize the mode of passion, that's their duty to have justice and fairness in the world, because when people have a materialistic mentality, if you don't have laws and you don't have justice, then they can't even rise to the mode of passion, what to speak of rising to the mode of goodness. So it's necessary here, but, you know, like in a prison, you have to put people in jail cells, but free people don't have to be in jail cells.
Fantastic.
Actually, if we're very attached to these concepts of justice and fairness, we're staying here. Those are very much mode of passion concepts. Okay, I think we'll end here. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.